It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, coping with the ups and downs of parenting an adolescent. In particular, we'll pay attention to kids who stray beyond normal rebellion and experimentation, kids who cut school, abuse alcohol and drugs, run away repeatedly, kids who become violent, threatening themselves or others. Dr. Scott Sells is our guest. He's a professor of social work at Savannah State University, and he heads the Savannah Family Institute. Over the past decade and a half, he's treated more than 300 difficult children. He's also served as a consultant to Georgia's Department of Juvenile Justice. Scott Sells is the author of two books. His latest is Parenting Your Out-of-Control Teenager, Seven Steps to Reestablish Authority and Reclaim Love. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. Perhaps you're facing a problem with a teen that you're not quite sure how to handle. Perhaps you've tried solving a problem but just haven't succeeded. Our guest may be able to help. He'll have some suggestions. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Parenting Your Out-of-Control Teenager, Scott Sells is the author of Treating the Tough Adolescent, a Family-Based Step-by-Step Guide. Scott Sells, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Two questions to begin with. Where's the line between normal rebellion and over-the-top, out-of-control rebellion, and what's the difference between serious and severe?
That's always a good question, because people that would be listening right now would be asking themselves that as the first question. And what we did in our four-year research study is look at what makes a kid go from just normal rebelliousness to what we call oppositional or out of control or extreme. And here's what the warning signs are. If your teenager or child is experiencing one of these seven behaviors, you listed a few of them at the introduction, but the key here is when I list these behaviors, ask yourself, is your teenager or child doing this for 6 months consistently? The defining line is the child consistently and persistently engaging in these behaviors for 6 months consistently? Because all teenagers will rebel, but the kids that separate out to out of control are ones that go way beyond just a few instances. And here's what to look for. Number one, a child or teenager that's extremely disrespectful consistently for 6 months or more. Then they get worse. Then you've got the second one, which is truancy or failing grades. Then running away. Then, as you mentioned earlier, threats or acts of violence. The next one is really a tough one, sexual promiscuity or teen pregnancy. The next one is drug or alcohol abuse. And the final one, which is the deadliest of all, is threats of suicide, because we found even if a teenager is just trying to manipulate, a lot of teenagers will do that, say that I want to kill myself. They don't really mean it, but they realize it has tremendous power. They may kill themselves by accident. And these seven behaviors are what we call extreme big guns that a teenager uses to commit acts of what's called parent abuse. We've all heard the term child abuse, but parent abuse is defined as a teenager's ability to use one of these seven behaviors I just listed to scare the parents into submission to giving back their authority right back to the parents, giving their authority right back to the kids. Because we found that when a kid comes in for counseling, when the parents start to take charge again, a teenager will actually develop these ACEs. Like, I had a teenager come in a couple weeks ago, and all the parents did is they came in for the big gun of disrespect. By the time the teenager was leaving my office, he was threatening to run away. Parents said to themselves, well, we've never had that problem before. We're coming to counseling. Our teenager is actually getting worse. The reason is because the teenager wanted to commit an act of parent abuse and get the parents to give up their authority because he saw that I was trying to give the authority back to the parents. Very creative, but very complicated, and if you don't know what you're doing, parents will take that the wrong way.
Okay, so what's going on? Why does a kid suddenly decide, let's pull some big guns. I got some aces up my sleeve. I'm going to put them on the table.
Bad behavior starts early. Usually when the child was younger, they were really, really defiant. And the parents either had advice from a parenting book or a pediatrician that the child would just grow out of it, but the behaviors just got extreme. And kids work off of the pleasure principle and they're drunk with power. Let's say you're a teenager who's kind of been oppositional as a kid but really learned that you've gotten your way. At first, it feels really like a drug to be in charge of your whole household at 13. But in order to keep that authority, you got to use more and more extreme behaviors. Because when the parents start to get consistent, the teenager will pull out a bigger gun, and it gets to be what's called a vicious cycle. So what happens is that teenagers often work off the pleasure principle, that they realize that, let's say a teenager says, oh, I want to go to a party. My parents haven't really been able to stop me when I was younger, so when they tell me I'm grounded, I'm just going to walk out the door because they have no counter move for that. So I'll take the punishment because I know it's not going to be a big deal, and I'd rather enjoy the pleasure of the moment of going to the party. Teenagers don't think past tomorrow, and nowadays it's even worse because I think teenagers are born from the womb now for instant gratification. I always tell a funny story to parents. I said, do you remember the days of old when you had to get up out of your chair and change the channels before remote controls and FedEx and instant messages? Well, as technology has grown, more and more kids don't have any frustration tolerance. They want it when they want it now. And so the traditional consequences that parents were taught by their parents, like grounding, taking away a toy, taking away television, teenagers that are in the extreme or out of control state just laugh at that because they know they can get around it very easily.
So if you've got this problem and it's been going on for 6 months or more, where do you start to get a handle on it?
First step in the book is once you understand why your teen misbehaves, and we go over those reasons, and I went over a couple. Then the first step, and it may sound trite, but it's really true, is that most of these parents have no written playbook or contract. We've heard about contracts all the time when we talk about parenting, but I found that every book I read on parenting before this book was written would not teach parents step by step how to put a good contract together. For example, let's take the problem of disrespect. Parents will just tell their kid that's out of control, if you do XYZ, then you're going to be grounded. Well, there's nothing written down. They haven't really defined what disrespect looks like, and they don't have, like, plan B if plan A fails. In other words, if they try to ground the kid and the kid walks out, what are they going to do? The parents are always two steps behind. So the first step is, and I talk about this in detail in the book, you got to write an ironclad contract. And the best example of this is when you look at lawyers, they get paid a lot of money when they write contracts because they know if two parties don't get along or they're having problems, they're worth their weight in gold if they can put a contract together that's ironclad, because if one party has a disagreement with the other, they can simply said read the contract. So everything's predetermined ahead of time. And I can't underestimate the power of contracts because it's like a rule book or a playbook that shows everybody what they've got to do, when they've got to do it, and it actually forces the parent to be more consistent. And so that's a first step.
Okay, so you want to be really clear about the rules.
Exactly, because teenagers will find loopholes. We found that oppositional kids have what's called literal disease. If it's not literally stated, they will find the loophole and defeat the parents before they even get off square one.
Yeah. Well, probably before we're teenagers, we've figured that one out.
Yes, really. I did it as a teenager. One of the reasons I became a counselor is because I was so out of control. My parents didn't know what to do, and I barely survived adolescence.
Really?
And the other thing that we noticed that happens is that parents who are in bitter arguments with their kids as years go on, all the softness gets sucked out of the relationship, so there's no nurturance. And what we found is that you can use tough love, and there is plenty of tough love things to do in the book just to get, you know, the authority back.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have the authority back, you've got to restore the love. Because my dad would tell you when I was an adolescent that he loved me, but he no longer liked me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad could put all the rules that he wanted on me, but without a nurturance relationship between my father and I was still going to rebel. It's kind of like rules without nurturance still leads to rebellion. And so parents get caught up in this power struggle with their kid, and they don't like their kid anymore, and so their kid goes outside the family to their peer group. And you've heard the term birds of a feather flock together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those teens also don't have nurturance problems, and so the teen doesn't have any kind of softness between their parents, and it starts to cause them to rebel more. Parents don't understand that a kid's misbehavior is as much connected to a lack of structure as it is to a lack of softness. Let me repeat that. A kid's misbehavior is as much connected to a lack of structure as it is to a lack of nurturance.
Okay.
So in step 7 of the book, we go over specific strategies to restore nurturance. One quick example is that I had a parent that I was working with who just disliked their kid, and I could see why, because their kid would swear at them every day. But when the parent got the message that their kid could calm down if they gave them unconditional love, and this parent started hugging their kid in the mornings, even when the kid went stiff as a board and pushed him away, because the kid's hug muscles were sore and out of practice because it hadn't happened for years, this kid actually started to soften right before both of our eyes because he couldn't figure out why his father was nurturing when he still called him, you know, swore at him. And that messed with the kid's wiring in his brain to the point where he actually developed shame and guilt again. And so that was a really good important example that I just shared in terms of how nurturance is so important.
Yeah, so you want to have rules and you want to be consistent with your kids, but you really want to show them you love them.
Yeah, and I think most books I've read on parenting don't do a good job of both. They either talk about nurturance or talk about hard rules and consequences, but you got to have a mixture of both love and limits together to turn an out-of-control teenager around.
Mm. I'm curious, what happened in your circumstances? Was the family able to come through this by taking action, or did you all just kind of manage just to fake your way through it?
Well, what happened was is we faked our way through it because we went to a counselor, and the counselor didn't know what they were doing. All they did is ask us how we felt. They didn't give my dad new skills, and everybody said we felt like crap, but then we didn't do anything after that. So I was, like, really angry at this counselor because I wanted skills from my parents. I didn't want them to tell me how I felt. And so that was a disaster, and we never went back. And so then what happened was I barely survived adolescence. I got into drugs, started running away, being disrespectful. My grades started to fall because my parents got divorced, and I could not stand my stepmother at the time. And it was just by sheer luck that I made it through. And then after I had to pay my first bills and went off to college, I got some responsibility back, and then my dad and I eventually reconciled through nurturance, and we're in good shape now. But I see parents as saying that adolescence is one of endurance. They've just got to get through it so the teenager doesn't self-destruct by killing themselves or others or hurting others. And it's a very difficult time because you're in an adult body, but you're still developing a child. And so, particularly in today's society, it's more difficult. So that's basically what happened with me.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned earlier a couple of things that are going on with kids. There's the power aspect going on. There's the pleasure thing going on. But eventually, I wonder if it just doesn't get to feel awful, not only for the parents, but for the child involved. You said when you and your parents went into counseling, yeah, everybody said, oh, we feel terrible.
Right.
So how do you reach into that part of your child that is feeling Also feeling uncomfortable, feeling awful, feeling trapped?
Yeah, I even wrote in a chapter in my book as an appendix, How to Find the Right Counselor, because I feel our mental health field is in a disaster zone right now, because you've got two philosophies out there. You've got a lot of people saying just drug kids, you know, put them on medication. And then you've got another group of people saying put them in boot camps or group homes. And then you got another group who just wants to talk about how you feel. When parents are in pain and angry at their kids, the first thing they want is not a bunch of therapy, but they want, here's what you do, here's how you do it, and here's what to do if it doesn't work. And that's why I'm so proud of this book, is because I cut through the theory and just talked about how to do it. Like, an example is parents don't understand that button pushing is really important, because we would have parents come in and say, I tried your contract of grounding my kid, and it didn't work, so give me another consequence. And so the therapist would try another consequence to suggest to the parents, and the same thing would happen over and over again. What they were missing was, is when the parents went home to deliver the consequence, their buttons got pushed. Every parent has what's called a thermonuclear button on their forehead. The teenager knows what it is. It could be swearing, it could be rolling their eyes, it could be saying, I don't love you. It doesn't matter. Every parent's different. And what we found was, is that we had to help the parents realize that their buttons were being pushed, and it didn't matter who was bigger or stronger.
Mm-hmm.
It was ever who was more skillful in an argument to control the mood of the other person. And if you go to Toys R Us, you see this all the time, like a four-year-old demands a toy and the parent says no. Then a little child starts to create a scene in the store. And as the longer the parent tries to rationalize with their little child, the more their chronological age drops right before your eyes, so you don't know who the parent is and who the kid.
Mm.
And that kid will often get the toy. And we found that it's all about the delivery. So what we've done to reach that inner child that you're talking about is we start by stopping the bleeding, by basically just showing parents how to get the sandstorm calmed down in their house, get their kid from stop running away, get their kid stop using drugs, and then we have the luxury and the time to get to the softness again. And it has to work that way, because if you watch a MASH episode, you know that Hawkeye says to the nurse, give me suction first. We got to stop the bleeding before I can get to the shrapnel. And so that's what we do in the book. We start with the limits first and then go into the love.
Mm. Sociologist Scott Sells is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Parenting Your Out-of-Control Teenager, 7 Steps to Reestablish Authority and Reclaim Love. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. A listener's waiting to talk with us on Line 1 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Well, this book really hits home, and I can't wait to get a copy of it. I have a 16-year-old son that fits all of these formats except for running away, though he has threatened if I put any guidelines down. His father and I divorced about 9 months ago,
okay.
And he's out of control.
Right. And do you have a sense that the divorce was the spark that lit the fuse, or was there signs even before the divorce?
There were some signs before.
Okay.
But it just really went off.
Was it a difficult divorce where you and your ex don't like each other and barely are able to speak to each other, or do you have a pretty good working relationship?
We have a silent relationship.
Which means that you don't talk and don't work as a team?
Correct.
Okay. It's your son, right?
Yes.
Does he play one off the other, like divide and conquer?
No, I did send him to live with his father for a while, and it was too controlling, so he came back with me, and I set limits and guidelines, curfews, but slowly those have been eroding away.
Right. What's your theory as to why your son is out of control. Do you have any theories? I always ask parents this, by the way, because I think it's a good place to start, is to ask yourself, what do you think your gut tells you as to why your teenager is out of control? And I want to ask you what you think, what's your gut tell you?
He's angry. He's angry about the breakup, but before the breakup, there was a lot of anger in the house. And so I think it was his reaction to that.
Okay, and do you love your kid but no longer like them anymore? Has it gotten to that point where the nurturance has kind of been drained from the relationship, or are you still able to separate out the misbehavior from your son?
It's getting hard.
Yeah.
I'm really at that verge.
Right. And do you have a written contract at home, or is it pretty much you do it off the cuff or as things come up?
It's off the cuff.
Right. And that is, you represent the majority of listeners out there, because what happens is that, do you sense that when it's off the cuff that you're two steps behind your teenager sometimes?
Oh, yes. I mean, this whole show...
Like they're already two steps ahead of you. Like if you say something, their mind's already going a mile a minute to figure out how to unravel anything that you put down.
Yeah.
Is the drug use big issue? You said he has that as one of the big guns that he uses. I'm wondering how big is the drug or alcohol abuse.
It's not out of control, but he's only 16.
Right. So is he using pot or is it just alcohol?
I'm not sure. I know that there probably has been some pot used, but mostly alcohol.
One thing that you can do in the book is there's a website you can go to called www.alcoholtesting.com, and you can actually order drug kits, and it'll show you in the book how to put that together. And actually objectively monitor the drug use and what plan B is if your teenager refuses to take the drug test. What the book will help you do is give you explicit directions on what to do to stop each one of these behaviors. And the threats of suicide one worries me the most. Did you say he has that one or does not have that one?
Excuse me, I didn't.
Is he threatening suicide?
No, he has not brought that up. No.
Okay, good, because I thought that was one that you said
no.
He did. Okay. So the one thing I'd like you to do, and if you email me directly, I'll give you this at no cost, is at www.difficult.net, I have what's called a parent survival kit, and it comes with the book, a workbook, and a videotape that kind of goes through each step on how to do it, because I'm a visual learner, and sometimes I have to see it to understand it. So if you email me at difficult.net, what is your first name?
Catherine.
Catherine, if you email me there, I will go ahead and ship you out a survival kit in the book as my gift to you.
Thank you. You know, I tried counseling, and yes, they were all about our feelings, and it didn't help us, and he got very put off, and there was no support from his father because people just get in your heads and tell you what to think.
Exactly, and it makes you confused because you don't know where to turn.
Right.
So thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free at 800-222-9455. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Dr. Scott Sells is our guest. He's a professor of social work at Savannah State University, and he heads the Savannah Family Institute. He's treated more than 300 difficult children. He's also served as a consultant to Georgia's Department of Juvenile Justice. His latest book, Parenting Your Out-of-Control Teenager, 7 Steps to Reestablish Authority and Reclaim Love. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, other calls are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Before we took that call, we talked a little bit about MASH and Hawkeye Pierce.
Right.
And, you know, trying to sort through, do a little triage and section the wound so you can see what the wound is, the extent of the wound, and that kind of thing.
Right.
To bring this into our lives and our living rooms and our kitchens and that kind of thing, the metaphor works to a certain extent. I mean, it's useful as a metaphor, but what do you do? I mean, how do you do it? There's lots of issues to be worked out here. Do you focus on one or two? Do you come up with a list and then sort it out? How do you go about this?
That's a great question. I'll give you kind of like a Cliff Notes version of the book. The first thing I do is help focus parents, because like this last caller said, she didn't know where to go first. She had drugs or alcohol, disrespect, school problems, and she's like thinking to herself, there's so many problems, where do I focus first? And so the first mini step under chapter two of the book, or step two called contracting, is to prioritize the number one and number two problem that you want to focus on first. See, what happens is that parents try to fight every battle at once. And it's like that old saying, you're a jack of all trades but a master of none. And so we basically say to the parents, okay, give us your list of your top three problems that you want to stop with your teen or child. Because believe it or not, even though this book was written for teens, so many parents have come up to me and said it works well with children. The next step is to say to yourself, out of the top three I listed, which one do I have the best chance of defeating in the quickest amount of time? Another metaphor I would like to use is that when you go to the gym, you don't immediately press 250 pounds because your muscles aren't warmed up. You're not used to the heavy equipment, so you have to use dumbbells. So a good example is, like, I had a parent come in and they had disrespect, and part of disrespect was not doing chores, running away, drug use. And I said, out of those three, as long as it's not life-threatening, like if they were using drugs way beyond just experimentation, you'd have to address that first. But I said, out of those three, which one do you think you might have a chance of winning the battle first with the least amount of energy? They said cleaning their room, but that's really not the big issue, of course. And I said, well, hold on for a second. If you can get your kid to clean your room using these steps in the contract, you'll have to use those same steps to get them to stop to use drugs. And they said, well, how does that work? I said, well, you have to monitor what a clean room looks like. You also have to monitor if they are clean and sober. You have to be consistent, because you have to be consistently enforcing a clean room, and you have to be consistently enforcing whether they're sober or not. So they got the message, and they used dumbbells to basically get the kid to clean their room, and that built momentum and confidence in the parents to go to the next thing. Then what you do is you do what will you do if scenarios, because what happens is that parents get lost, like this mother just called, where the kid has a counter move for every move the parent makes. For example, let's take the clean the room example. I always tell parents, okay, you've got to have a separate contract that you put in your sock drawer that the kids don't see. And here's the questions you have to ask. What will you do if your teenager refuses to clean the room? What will you do if you go into the room and they're not following what a clean room looks like? What will you do if your teen doesn't take the drug test that you're giving them? What will you do if you try to ground them and they run away? What I'm getting at here, this is called troubleshooting. You have to have plan Bs for every counter move that the teenager might make, because if you don't, the teenager will be glad to do that for you because they're great attorneys. So what it does is it puts parents in a proactive position instead of a reactive position. Then you've got to look at button pushing, because if the parents get their buttons pushed and they take it personal, mm-hmm. the kid knows that and will push their buttons to cloud their judgment and their mood, and then none of these consequences will work because the kids are masters at pushing their parents' buttons. So those are like the foundational steps in a nutshell. And then the consequences have to be creative. In Chapter 5 of the book, it's called Neutralizing the Seven Aces. And like a recipe menu, you go over each ace, like disrespect, and you find six or seven consequences that are created for disrespect, truancy. Let me give you one quick example. This single-parent mother could not get her kid to go to school no matter what, and the kid would not stop running away. There's a section in the book called The Consequence That Kids Care About, and like there's 10 things that teenagers care about. Like they care about money, they care about freedom, they care about their parents, they care about material stuff like CDs, they care about their friends. So I asked this mother, okay, out of this top 10 list, pick the one thing that your teen cares about most. And she said her appearance, but there's nothing I can come up with to change her appearance. And I said, well, hold on there, Mom. Go to the book and look under appearance, cross-reference it with running away, and look at the consequence, and it's called the stealth bomber consequence. What we did with the mom is the mother got a picture of the daughter without any makeup on, her hair sticking straight up from last Christmas. We went to Kinko's and printed out flyers, wanted posters, that had the number for information leading to her whereabouts, and we posted them everywhere the daughter hung out and at school. Now, the daughter was so mortified that she called immediately from her friend's house that she was staying at and said, please, I will do anything but take these posters away. They are embarrassing me. That was a good example of how we found the teenager's Achilles heel, her pressure point, because every teenager is different, and the consequences that are given to parents today aren't out-of-the-box thinking. And that was an example of how we were able to stop the bleeding. Then when the daughter came home, then we found out why she was running away, and that was because mother was very critical, punitive, no nurturance, and so it was toxic at home, and this daughter was running away from the toxicity at home. But the mother would only go towards nurturance once we had stopped the bleeding by at least getting her daughter to come home.
Yeah, it's...
Sorry, it was a long-winded thing.
No, I'm thinking, though, you know, but isn't there a risk there that you're making that relationship even more toxic with the wanted posters?
There is, but it's kind of like desperate times call for desperate measures. In other words, you have a tough decision to make. The relationship is going to die a slow or quick death if the daughter continues to run away. And what could happen is the longer the daughter's running away, the chances go up that she could die. She could be raped. She could be take drug overdose. And so you have to figure out a way, even if it makes the relationship initially a little bit worse, just to get the daughter home so that she can work on the relationship. And so it's a lesser of two evils approach. And it's real clear in the book that you only use these creative consequences as a last resort. What's amazing is that consequences that are less extreme, like grounding or taking the phone away, can suddenly work if, like the mother on the call that came in, was consistent, had a written contract, didn't let her buttons get pushed, did troubleshooting, because every battle's won before the first shot is ever fired. And so I teach parents to only go to these last resort consequences if the lesser consequences don't work. And by what I mean by that is try the principles in the book, put together an ironclad contract, do your logistics differently, and you will see all of a sudden consequences that never worked before suddenly work. Because you know what kids tell me all the time? They say to me, don't tell my parents this, but I want structure. I need structure. I crave structure. But what I don't like is when my parents are inconsistent, they break promises, they don't follow through, and they don't reward me for good behavior. The only time I get attention is when I mess up. I'd never get rewarded for when I do good. So in the contracts, we show parents how to give rewards to kids that follow the rule and natural logical consequences when they don't. And that mirrors the real world, doesn't it? Because if we go to work and our boss said to us, okay, I'm not going to allow you to have any voice in this policy change at work. I'm going to only talk to you when you mess up. but you should work and do and be a really good worker just because you it's good to work in general. How many of us would stay with that job? No one would. Yet most parents will only tag the misbehavior of a teenager and not praise the good behavior.
Mm. We've talked some about button pushing in terms of the buttons that parents have in the middle of their foreheads, but kids have them too.
Yeah, that's a very important point. You know, in an argument, it takes two to tango. What we have parents do is look at the top eight buttons that they push on teenagers, and some of them are, some parents lecture and preach. Some parents like talk in chapters, like instead of just saying, take out the garbage, they go on and on by saying, you know, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, and we teach parents how the teenager goes instantly deaf when they hear that, or collect criticisms where any argument, the parent has a mental scorecard for all the kids' past sins, and they bring it up. And so we actually have the teenagers pick out their top three buttons that parents push on them, and we put them on post-it notes. And we have the teenager put them on their forehead, all the buttons that teens push on them. And we have the parents put the top three buttons that teens push on them on their forehead. And we actually have them engage in an argument that they had recently, like a role play, and have them begin to see how both each party pushes each other's buttons. Because people are visual learners. And everything we do, and that's why I plugged the website, difficult.net, because we have videos that the parents can pick up while they're reading the book to actually see how it works, not just read about it in a book.
Yeah. This was also an interesting part of the book. This is part of the chapter on writing an ironclad contract. Questions to ask your child that actually engage them, and you advise, of course, when you're both in a good mood.
Right.
And there aren't other distractions around, but there are four questions. Let's share them with listeners this afternoon. I think they could be very useful.
Well, one question that I, you know, like to ask is, how can I be helpful to you? Or, in solution focused questions, you know, if a miracle happens and, you know, we were getting along better, what would that look like? And then also, what kind of rewards would you give yourself for following these following the rules of the house? And basically, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And did I miss one? I think you might have it in front of you.
Yeah, I think I want to know how I can be helpful to you.
Right.
What things have I done or said in the past that weren't helpful or turned you off so that we can avoid making the same mistakes in the future?
Right.
And what keeps you going? How come you haven't thrown in the towel?
Right. Those are questions that we never ask our kids, and kids always tell me that if my parents would catch me in a good mood and talk to me like an adult and ask for my opinion, I'd be much more cooperative than they ever think possible, because they never ask my opinion. They never ask for my input. They just come into my bedroom and say, okay, here's how it is. This is what you're going to do. And if you don't do it, that's too bad. Mm-hmm. My dad always used to do that. So it's all about my dad. And I never had a voice. And it wasn't until later on that I started working with kids that I found a way that parents could ask their kids for a voice and help write the contract. And the research is clear on this. If a person is a co-owner of a plan, their cooperation goes sky high because they're part of that plan. And most counselors I found either just ask the kid to put the contract together or just ask the parents. But they don't mediate between the two sides to help them put it together as a team.
Yeah. Well, and also when you're asking questions, make sure that you're asking questions that show that you care about the answers and you're going to listen.
I mean, there's this one thing in the last chapter on nurturance is understanding underlying feelings. Like when your kid comes home and you ask them how their day was at school, and they said, it was horrible. And then you instantly try to solve the problem and say, well, you should do this, you should do that. You know, the kids don't want to hear that. They want to be heard. In other words, they want you to say, so it sounds like you're pretty angry right now. You know, and you're not solving the problem, but you're asking for people's, you're asking your teenager to check out what their underlying feelings are. And as a spouse or significant other, when you come home from a hard day, you don't want your spouse or partner to just solve the problem. You just want to be heard. You want, it's like music to your ears when you come home and say how horrible your day was, for your spouse to say, so it sounds like you're frustrated, am I close or way off? I mean, that may sound like a therapist, but for a lot of people, they just want to be heard.
Let's talk with another caller. On the campus of the U of I on line one, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I heard you mention earlier that one of the things parents do these days is refer their kid to like a boot camp program or like a therapeutic boarding school program, and I wondered what you thought if you felt that was ever the right thing to do, a right choice or a good choice to make.
That's an excellent question, and there's two ways of looking at that. Sometimes parents are so burnt out and things are so bad that they need a respite from each other. And so sometimes if it's allowed or it can be done, I'll have parents go that route, but only as a last resort, because here's the double-edged sword of that. In today's society, more and more I see this happening. A teenager will leave home and go to a therapeutic boot camp or group home, come back and look for the first 2 months, like a honeymoon period, fixed. They'll look better, seem better, sound better, won't do drugs, more respectful, and then all of a sudden they start to go back to the old behaviors. Now, why is that? Now, here's what teens have told me. Teens will tell you, if you ask them in the right frame of mind, the right time, they'll say, the reason I go right back to my old behaviors is because the counselors out at the camp or the group home did all the fixing, but my parents haven't changed the way they do parenting when I left home to when I came back in. It's like you can take me out of the home, but you can't take the home out of me. And so one of the things that I saw on Primetime Live, which was just so disturbing, were these two twin boys that were being filmed by these cameras in the trailer. And you saw that they went off to residential treatment for 6 months, came back in the first couple weeks. Things were better, but the mother started to lecture the same way she always did, was inconsistent the way she was. So the kids had gotten all the skills, but the mother had gotten nothing, only a couple weeks of skills.
Mm-hmm.
And the counselors were just blaming the mother right and left, telling them that the kids needed to be back on medication, and nobody looked at the answer, which was changing the dance steps between mother and son instead of looking at internal answers like take the kid out, fix them, fix the mother. Why not work on the dance steps between the two? So what I'm seeing right now is, you've heard the term, it takes a village to raise a child, but the village that is raising our children are social services, judges, medication. It's not like the old days when our families were raised by neighbors, ministers, friends, extended family, and I think we got to go back to basics. And one of the chapters in my book talks about how parents, even if they're isolated in their community, can get help from these natural support systems like friends, neighbors, ministers, to help get them back in charge. So I know that's a long way of answering your question, but it's not as easy as just a one-sentence answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate
You're
it.
Welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, a few minutes back, you mentioned you know, the fact that when you go into a gym, you can't press 250 pounds immediately.
Right.
If you start working and you keep the faith and you work in good faith, how long is it? Can you say something encouraging for parents who are out there who are feeling tired and burnt out? How long, you know, when can I expect to see some results?
Well, every child is different, but as a rule of thumb, and the hundreds of kids I've treated, kids respond to the right kind of structure immediately. They don't get better overnight, because remember, this took a long time to get to the where it where it became out of control, and it's like smoking. You can't just get rid of it overnight. But what's encouraging to parents who use this model is they do see changes right away. They're not big, but they keep seeing small changes. And so the average parent that I've worked with usually sees changes within 3 to 6 weeks and major changes within 3 to 6 months. And what we've done to help parents along, because I'm not really trusting the mental health system to do the raising of our kids, is I've put together a parenting program that we're doing in Leesburg, Virginia, right outside of D.C. We're going to be doing it in Louisville, Kentucky. My goal now is to spread this 6-week parenting program all over the country, because what's happening is it's in 6 weeks the parents get all the skills from the book, but then they're taught to help each other out, and what we're creating is alumni support groups so that parents don't feel so alone and they can actually ask each other for support. What I find is that parents are very ashamed. They don't go and tell people like their family, friends, or coworkers, hey, I've got an out-of-control kid, because it's embarrassing. So they suffer in silence. And in the isolation comes problems, because the kid gets more and more out of control. And so I'm a big believer that parents can heal themselves with the right skills that they weren't taught by their parents, and customize it for the out-of-control teenager. I am a big believer that someday, maybe I'm an optimist, that we'll have parenting groups all over the country using this kind of approach or something like it, where the parents take back control of their household but also restore nurturance back with their kid.
That's where we have to leave it. We're out of time. Dr. Sells, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're
Scott Sells has been our guest. He's a professor of social work at Savannah State University. He heads the Savannah Family Institute. His latest book, Parenting Your Out-of-Control Teenager, 7 Steps to Reestablish Authority and Reclaim Love. The book is published by St. Martin's Press.